everything feels great. It sounds so dead in here. It's like dead and quiet. But enough of this. We're going to get to the episode now. So thank you for tuning in. Cybernetics. But it still fits within the rubric of computation and mathematics as well. Rather than assuming that Native American mathematicians must be restricted to simple counting systems or geometric forms, we should be open to any mathematical pattern that appears, including those which are embedded, emergent, or obscured by difficulties in translation to their Western counterparts. Ding, ding, ding. Equally important, we should strive to show the interrelationships amongst such culturally embedded mathematical concepts. So we're going to use a few examples to show how such an approach can open new possibilities through computation, complexity, and coding in Native American knowledge systems and beyond. And so the first would be algorithmic complexity and biodiversity. Gary Nabhan, an agriculture researcher who works with Native American growers, noted that sustaining genetic diversity was an important theme in indigenous knowledge systems. In searching for greater crop variety, Nabhan found that those areas with the strongest focus on ceremonial religious practices were also those with the greatest diversity in genetic resources. For example, a rare bean variety was propagated for a winter ceremony in which it is sprouted in the underground kivas. A rare variety of sunflower had also been maintained, growing weed-like around the fields because its petals were used to make the yellow ceremonial face paint. And so Cutler in 1944 found that South American medicine men often conducted a ritual in which they were propagating pod corn, a variety that cannot be grown naturally because each kernel is covered by a heavy husk. Even outside of these ceremonial settings, Native American farmers still cited the religious framework as their reason for maintaining genetic diversity. On one occasion, I asked a Hopi woman at Munkapi if she selected only the biggest corn kernels of all one color for planting her blue maize. She snapped back at me, "It is not a good habit to be too picky. We have been given this corn, small seeds, fat seeds, misshapen seeds, all of them. It would show that we are not thankful for what we have received if we plant just certain ones and not others." And this is a quote from Nabhan from 1983. Why should Native American religions have such a strong emphasis on maintaining a more complex set of genetic resources? From a biological point of view, these turn out to be crucial for coping with environmental uncertainty. The winter ceremony bean has strong resistance against root knot nematodes. Not a typical problem, but in years with a nematode epidemic, it could be the key to survival. The wild sunflower is not edible, but it can cross-fertilize with the cultivated versions and thus adds more genetic potential for adaptations. Cutler had similar ideas and suggested the figure of the Cocopelli, the humpback flute player of Southwestern iconography, was an image of one of the herbalists from the South American tradition. Everybody's seen a Cocopelli before. They're in like, what's the name of that Java cafe style? Like a World Cafe. What's the name of it? It's that like PC. What's the name of that? I'm going to have to look that up. Well, anyways, Oh, Global Coffee House. That's the name. And you guys probably know what that looks like. So a lot of browns, a lot of steaming hot coffee. So the Global Village Coffee House is the name for a network of related aesthetics that emerged in the late 80s and peaked in the mid-90s, fading out of the collective consciousness sometimes in the early 2000s. It's that earth-tone woodcut spiral, Cocopelli figure, tribal-themed coffee shop style that never seemed to have a name, but was omnipresent nonetheless. So the common threads are a revival of this watered-down artistic movement, an appropriation of a hodgepodge of global aesthetics, which was basically a reaction against the sleek, clean, synthetic, and luxurious designs of the early mid-1980s. So, like, and I'm going to actually go into an essay by Evan Collins from 2018 called The Global Village Coffeehouse Aesthetic. Like all trends, this one stems from a confluence of socioeconomic and cultural forces. Articles in design magazines from the time credit its emergence to the economic recession of the early 1990s, a shifting political climate, the resurgence of the environmental movement, and a collective feeling of shame surrounding the excess of the 1980s. Expensive metallic foils, Pacific Wave-style computer graphics, and bright Memphis colors to the prior decade were replaced with rough textured paper, twigs and twine as binding, and a vaguely tribal hieroglyphic-inspired iconography. In essence, the organic took the place of the synthetic, a visual cue that consumers in this new decade wanted to see themselves, at least superficially, as eco-conscious, spiritually aware, and worldly. The progenitors of the GVC aesthetic were originally considered part of the cutting edge in 1980s graphic interior industrial design. Furniture by Francois Trobat, along with the interiors of Jordan Moser and Gaetano Pessi, eschewed clean Memphis forms in favor of an earthy, whimsical style. Later chains like Starbucks and Panera Bread still is holding down the Global Village coffee house style, mimics these qualities, replicating the same simplified motifs across thousands of stores. So the design writers from the era mention how the woodcut scratchboard print, a trend that would later come to be a dominant stylistic element of GVC, was originally seen in magazines like Wigwag, a 1989 down-to-earth counterpart to the satirical Spy magazine. Keith Haring's signature simple figures, motion, expression lines, and themes of human emotion and unity eventually filtered into GVC's designs as well. Though stripped of their political themes and recontextualized to fit commercial applications, GVC also periodically incorporated lowbrow and pop surrealist motifs, although in a more restrained, neutral manner designed not to offend or unnerve the viewer. As seen in corporate stock illustrations. And so this kind of actually ties in with the rapid acceleration of globalization and contributes to this kind of like aspect of, you know, indigenous, worldly, tribal kind of vibe. And it was kind of, even like there's cases being made, let's not get carried away here, but heralded as a new wave of imperialism in the form of corporate exploitation of emerging countries and global cultures. In the 1990s, Western nations developed a fascination with various global cultures through their increasing visibility in media consumer products, which this was, you know, kind of like, let's tie some other stuff in here. World music, global fusion cuisine, New Age spirituality. And so the overall zeitgeist manifested in the appropriation of iconography, you know, which was associated with ancient and indigenous cultures. So these are things like the globalization gaze, tribal figures shown carrying executives serving coffee or holding up a stool accompanied by the caption, designed for those who hanker for the days when porters took a load off their feet. So a lot of this stuff you could find in illustrations. I remember in Wired magazine, for example, like old Wired magazines are just full of Global Village Coffee House. So basically, the failed predictions of this harmonious global village as this extremely bourgeois corporate aesthetic kind of died. You know, like we look at this stuff and we all kind of laugh at it as if it's some relic or whatever. And it's incredibly difficult to appropriate it. Although there is this place in Austin called the Java Cafe, and I went back there and they've got all the Coca Pellies. But these are like Texans. It's not the same vibe. It's like a mom and pop family run coffee shop that has great food, great coffee. And, you know, it's like, this is kind of what this is, you know, country folk trying to be worldly. So it's interesting to see it filtered through something like that as well. But other than the Java Cafe in Austin near the Domain, and maybe a few gift shops in New Mexico, you really don't see this vibe that much, which I almost kind of see as a shame in a weird way, because at least it reminds us of this period now. We're back to this corporate Memphis, very sleek, cynical aesthetic that in a lot of ways obfuscates even the notion of hope itself or some sort of like ultimate reconciliation in this world. Not to go on a little side tangent, but that's to be expected. So the Coca Pelli used in these coffee shops, its origin was that of a fertility figure. And also, they've historically traveled north, at least as far as Central America. And it's a sort of this iconography of somebody who travels with flutes and backpacks. And so you could see this, how the link between plant diversity and animal diversity of strong concern in today's environmental framework was part of this traditional knowledge system. The systemic relations between the complexity and uncertainty was not restricted to plant and animal genetics. Native Americans also made a similar correspondence in the stories of the creator, trickster, coyote, as we see in the Navajo story of creation. First man, first woman, and coyote were not satisfied with the sky, so they searched for glittering stones and found some mica dust. First man placed the star, which does not move, known to be Polaris, at the top of the heavens. Then he placed the four bright stars at the four quarters of the sky. Then in a hurry, Coyote scattered the remaining mica dust so it did not fall into exact patterns, but scattered the sky with irregular patterns of brilliance. And this is from Berlind in 1968. And his studies. While people are creating order, Coyote is creating randomness, tossing bits of rock into the sky. For Native Americans, randomness is not merely a colloquial expression. Random tosses were precisely gauged in their gambling procedures. Asher, in 1990, described a vivid illustration in the Native American game of Dish. In the Cayuga version of the game, six peach stones blackened on one side are tossed and the total number landing on the black side or brown side recorded as the outcome. The traditional Cayuga point scores for each outcome are rounded to whole numbers, the exact values calculated by probability theory. In the Navajo story cited above, Coyote, acting in his usual haphazard way, creates rain and brings the seeds of all the plants. The idea of creating an irregular complexity of genetic resources to match the irregular randomness of natural events is thus deeply embedded across many Native American societies and in diverse aspects of their knowledge systems. It is also a foundational concept for certain measures of complexity used in modern mathematics. Part 2, Complexity and Computation, the Kolmogorov-Chaitin Measure. The first mathematical models for complexity was developed in the work of A.N. Kolmogorov and G. Chaitin in the late 1950s. noting that some apparently random numbers can be completely determined by a simple algorithm, Kolmogorov and Chatelain proposed that the algorithmic complexity of a number was equal to the length of the shortest algorithm required to produce it. This means that periodic numbers, such as 0.12121212121, will always have a low algorithmic complexity. Even though the number is infinitely long, the algorithm can simply say repeat 12 forever. A longer algorithm like that requires to produce pi would have a higher algorithmic complexity. So truly random numbers have the highest algorithmic complexity possible, since their only algorithm is the number itself. For an infinite length, you get infinite complexity. From a mathematical point of view, this is why Native American knowledgeists place a strong emphasis on maintaining biodiversity. Since algorithmic complexity increases with randomness, coyotes' random natural events can only be matched by the maximum in genetic resource complexity. But the parallels may be more than just analogy. Miguel Jimenez Montaño published what several researchers have regarded as one of the most workable systems for measuring algorithmic complexity, a system he devised at the University of Veracruz in Mexico for use on amino acids in genetic sequences. Jimenez Montaño credits his PhD advisor Werner Ebeling. Ooh, wow, that's crazy. As the main scientific inspiration for his research, but he was well aware of the indigenous plant complexity, having long been a friend of Maria Vasquez, a distinguished botanist in the Biological Institute at the University of Veracruz, who studied archaeological data on the plants used by the indigenous societies of Mexico. Although it may have only been a subliminal or indirect influence, it wouldn't take much of a stretch to think about Native American complexity concepts as one of the influences in Jimenez Montaño's work. The difficulty in practical application to the Kolmogorov-Chatelain measure is that they used a class of universal symbol-generating systems called the Turing machine, named after Alan Turing, which was a British mathematician. So Jimenez Montaño's insight was in applying a more restricted set of procedures, what computation theorists call a context-free grammar, for generating the symbols, which makes it easier to ensure that one has actually found the minimal length algorithm. In a context-free grammar, we begin with a starting symbol S and then produce rules which tell you how to replace previous symbols with new ones. So a list of terminal symbols tells you which cannot be further replaced.